when you're talking about like a fascist state, you're talking about something that has to be positioning itself as both incredibly powerful and always the victim. This idea of AI as a tool of fascism. Fascism is make-believe at gunpoint. The only tool is violence. And the only kind of thinking is fantastical, right? It's just this imaginary thing that they're making up and then forcing everybody to play along with. AI is a perfect tool for that because it is ready-made to make up whatever you want. And it makes it so that not only can you see whatever you want to see, but you can also kind of create doubt about everything. It's not so much like the creation of a specific lie, right? As this is an attack on the idea of truth as a knowable thing.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about hate.
The fuel that drives our passion to destroy.
Absolutely. Indeed.
Yeah, that's the poetic view anyway. Yeah, let's talk about it because we have to use hate as a way to challenge the somewhat smarmy approach that the AI industry has attacked us. So yeah, let's get someone on board who really knows about how to express this far better than we do.
Let's do it. So I'm really happy we're joined tonight or this afternoon, depending on your frame of reference, by Anthony Moser, who wrote a fantastic article a few months back called I Am an AI Hater. So, you know, it says it right on the 10. Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we dive into the essay itself, as I understand, you are a musician, and I'm just wondering if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little about who you are beyond the AI hating.
Yeah, I do have a couple albums out there, just Anthony Moser, if you want to look it up. But I haven't played out for a while. I kind of stopped when the pandemic started, and I had planned to like kind of get back out there when I was like, oh, well, I'll see when things get a little bit safer. And then it kind of turned out the world didn't work that way. But, you know, I still try to play and always have some stuff that I'm working on, play guitar and sing and kind of in the blues, jazz, folk area.
Gotcha. So you're sitting in Chicago, I believe you said, right?
That's right, yeah.
Good town for blues.
It is, yeah. I actually, I spent about 11 years working at Buddy Guy's Blues Club.
Wow.
Yeah, started out as a bar back, ended up doing a lot of internet, social media, live streaming before it was kind of a big thing. It was a great experience.
Yeah, great. So now that we know a little more about you, just wondering what drove you to write this piece, I Am an AI Hater?
I think I'd started, the impetus for me was like, I think I'd seen some more articles talking about, you know, so-and-so AI critic or, you know, this, you know, critics say this, critics say that kind of stuff. And I'd posted on Blue Sky. I was like, you know, if anybody ever interviews me about this, I would like to be listed not as a critic, but as a hater. Like, because I don't want any ambiguity about this. And then I, you know, kind of went from there, kind of having crystallized the thought about it. And I had kicked around, you know, kind of what I was trying to express with it for a while. And I often, I guess, find the experience to be like, you have a kernel of an idea and sometimes it just kind of needs to simmer for a bit before kind of clicks into place. Because I'd thought about like, well, maybe I kind of want to explain a little bit about how they work or, you know, how this, that, and eventually I was like, you know, there's a lot of stuff actually that does this already. And that's not really what I even want to express. And so, yeah, I often think of writing as kind of a process of distilling and condensing. you know, like, what is it that I really want to convey in the, like, the simplest and most direct terms that I can? Yeah, I think, like, a lot like other kinds of distillation, if you do it right, you end up with, like, you know, kind of a high proof outcome.
Yeah.
Well, it's powerful stuff, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, interesting, like, thing about politeness is, I was wondering whether, I mean, you know, apart from, like, on the internet, there's a lot of polemicism on the internet. You know, it definitely feels like it's okay to say that you hate AI. What's the kind of feedback been like from the article, from the essay?
I wasn't actually expecting to get all that much response from it. I mean, I had kind of thought maybe there'd be a place around where I was like, maybe is there, you know, a site where I should try to pitch this? Like, is there, you know, somewhere that would want to publish it? And I kind of poked around to see if there were any likely candidates, and it didn't seem like anybody was really going to be the right place to publish something with kind of the voice that I wanted to bring to it. And I didn't want to put it on Medium. I'd posted some stuff on Medium like a while back or whatever, but it's one of these other things where like the platform has just kind of continually swallowed everything. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
Fine, I'm just going to put up my own site and I'll share it there. I also kind of had expected that once I put it out there that that I would get a lot of argument, you know, or people kind of chiming in to be like, what about this or what about that, or, you know, kind of defending it. But it was overwhelmingly positive. I had people just emailing me out of the blue to be like, I'm an AI hater too now, you know, like, this is, thank you for saying this.
Like us.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean,
come on our podcast.
Yeah, and I actually, it seemed like a lot of people, one of the things that they were expressing was that they felt like it was articulating something that they had felt, but didn't really know exactly how to express. And I think, I mean, that was, you know, very gratifying. And I also think that it kind of reflects, I think it reflects some of this framing around kind of politeness and civility and like the ways that you're allowed to talk about things. Because that's where it started off too. It's like that was, I had the first paragraph like immediately where it's like, this is the way you're supposed to talk about this, right? It's like, well, everyone's like, well, it doesn't really work great in my field, but I'm sure in these other areas it's probably fine. and you know, everybody wants to be seen as reasonable.
Yes.
And you know, well, of course, you know, I'm not going to say that it can't be good or that it, you know, whatever. I think that's really been kind of strategically weaponized, like, by the companies that are building this stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it's very much in tune with kind of the way that, like, civility discourse, you know, is a weapon of white supremacy, respectability, politics, all of this kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say about respectability politics. Yeah. Pull your trousers up. Yeah.
Well, and I guess I was thinking about this today. Like, what is it that makes things rude? Or kind of what is kind of the basis of like politeness? I think part of what's happening here is that politeness requires a shared context about what the expectations are, you know? So like y'all invited me to be here, right? And, you know, we had this discussion about kind of what that's going to look like. And, you know, a polite conversation would be the expectation that like, you know, you're going to bring up some questions and we'll talk about it and we'll have this discussion, like, and all of that is great. If this was a different context, right? Like if I was out to have dinner with my wife, you know, and like you started coming up to ask questions about something, like, then, you know, it would be very like, we're eating over here, you know, like, yeah. And at a certain point, you know, if you tell somebody like, hey, like, fuck off, like, leave us alone. Yeah. Like, you know, at that point, is that still rude? Like, yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of always is, but it's not inappropriate. You know, like, it's,
I mean, you're met with rudeness to some extent. People are being rude to you.
That's the thing about it, right? And I think part of what makes rudeness rude, and you know, kind of by definition, is in some ways, it's a rejection of what is supposed to be an accepted context.
Yeah.
And I think part of what we see around all this stuff is that essentially they have already created a context and then they are saying that it's rude to question it without having, you know, asked if you want to enter into it. You know, they're showing up at dinner whether you want them there or not, right? Like they want you to wear this thing around and be part of the conversation. And that's why, you know, I said later on in the piece, right? It's like, I'm here to be rude because this is a rude technology.
I think on some level, people know that because one of the things you say almost at the end, you say, I do understand you want permission.
Yeah.
So people know that they're being a bit naughty, right? And they want you to say, oh, okay, I understand why you're using AI for that. But, you know, your piece is basically like, no, I'm not going to give you permission. You know, this is bullshit. I'm just going to call it.
Yeah. And, you know, I know I did get into there at the, you know, at the end kind of talking about folks kind of rolling over and kind of accepting and going with this. But obviously, like, I direct most of, I think, my anger around this towards the people who are choosing to make this. Yeah. You know, like the real consent violations here are like the fact that they are scraping and stealing all of this stuff and bringing it together to build these things in the first place. And then, you know, forcing it into the workplace, forcing it into, you know, educational environments and trying to just force it on everybody. Because actually kind of bringing it back to this question of like kind of what is the context and did you agree to be in it? Y'all had had, I think, Chris Gilyard on here a while back. Yeah. All right. Yeah. And I think he's maybe, I'm paraphrasing badly here, but I think I remember him saying something to the effect of like, you know, these are machines to build to kind of force a worldview on other people. Like the way this is built is to bring other people into your context, like involuntarily. And I think that's kind of a through line in really both how they're constructed, how they work, and how they're being deployed.
Yeah, the thing I was going to say about the move fast and break things is that it's a kind of Silicon Valley mantra, you know, that they're here to disrupt, they're here to upend conventions. And because of that, it feels like somehow they've got permission to break everything. That's a sort of weird thing to me because it's been granted by the governments of the US for like at least four or five presidents now. You know, it started with Obama, and then it went on with Trump, and it went, you know, carried on with basically everyone saying that either the tech companies were like underrepresenting them, or they were like agents of great good for the American, I don't know, the national kind of like the economy, for example, or the demonstration that the US was innovative and able to, you know, still invent things. And it feels like it's soured quite a lot in the last decade, probably since Trump's election. I don't know. What do you feel about that? Do you feel like it has been building up this permission structure, or do you feel like it was just kind of bolt out of the blue, you know? Because it feels like it's been building to me at least.
Yeah, I guess I think one of the continuing patterns that we see around technological development is people using the framing or rhetoric of this is something that's new,
right,
as a way of claiming that existing rules no longer apply and that existing regulations no longer apply, and just sort of like, well, how are we going to handle this brand new thing? When in fact, in a lot of ways, it is continuous. It is continuous with like the patterns of technological development beforehand. And so much of the tech hype stuff is just like labor violations on computers. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
And
because it's an app, it's not against the law, as Cory Doctorow likes to say.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I do think that a lot of that is wearing off in some of the public mindset. I think partly maybe that the cycle has gotten so fast that people have gotten more aware of it. But I think it's also just more overt, mm-hmm. the hostility, right, frankly, and extractiveness towards users of things, where at one point there was sort of a pretense that you had to be providing a meaningful value. And now it's much more of just like, this is what we're going to do, and it's the only way you can get anything.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, what you said about laws and regulations and so on, you know, there is a lot of, I guess, public demand these days for regulating AI, regulating big tech. But I think the interesting thing is that we have plenty of laws and regulations that they're violating now, right? They're already on the books. And the point you make about they used to have to at least pretend to offer some value, you know, like Facebook was, whatever, connecting the world, presumably for the good of its users. But, you know, as these companies have just gotten bigger and more powerful, there are, what, seven big tech companies that are, the valuation of the top seven tech companies is like over half of the US stock exchange or something ridiculous like that. you know, these giant monopolies, like you basically cannot hold them to account, or at least that's what they would have us believe. And we did kind of see a spark of that during the Biden administration where, you know, you had heroes like Lina Khan. But, you know, with Trump coming in, that seems to have just all gone away, right? So as an artist, I guess copyright probably means something to you, right?
Honestly, I tend to think of copyright as, I've kind of come to think of them as what I call airlock problems, which is that it's not really a great or useful framework, I think, in terms of understanding how musical or artistic or cultural ideas propagate, to be like, I own this piece of it. It's not very practical in that way. And like a lot of other things kind of in a capitalist society, it's like it becomes weaponized often like by capital. However, if you decide at the moment, right, at a moment where we have intense concentration of capital and power, that the answer is just to, you know, open the airlock door and be like, all right, well, we're just not going to have this anymore.
Right.
The functional equivalent is that a lot of people are going to get blown out into space. And so it's like, if we want to get rid of copyright, which I would love to see happen, honestly.
Yeah.
It's not that you can just say, all right, well, that doesn't exist anymore at this moment where we have, you know, intense precarity. It's that we need to change the surrounding conditions to where we can do this without kind of causing a lot of immediate harm and taking away kind of one of the few protections that does still like exist for creative people.
But the funny thing about a lot of the cases recently, like the classic example, well, the classic example, it's can't be exactly classic, it's so new, is the Sora 2 stuff where people were making like, you know, Hitler versions of Pikachu until eventually Sony just said, yeah, stop this. Because OpenAI said that copyright holders essentially have to tell us.
Opt out, yes.
You have to opt out. Yeah. The thing about copyright to me is at the moment, at least, I get it that like Sony and Disney and companies like that are going to be annoyed and they're going to come to some settlement with OpenAI or tell OpenAI to stop. But like you say, it's a sort of like a long tail problem or a mid tail problem. You know, if you haven't got $1 billion to throw at this, you know, if you haven't got 150,000 lawyers to throw at the problem, then I think you're kind of shit out of luck.
Yeah, I agree that it's not a meaningful tool of action for an individual to take up against a company. And that's why I think when you see some of this stuff happening, it is happening as these class action lawsuits and these kind of collective things. Honestly, I think the most significant protections that have come into place around creative work and AI, I think, have largely been a result of unions and workplace organizing protections.
Right.
And that is not surprising, I guess, I think, because, you know, thinking about it as a violation of property rights and kind of approaching it through that framework is going to be kind of inherently limiting because it sort of grants the premise of the whole system, you know, around the accumulation of property wealth as like kind of a core concern, as opposed to taking collective action of people to kind of make determinations about their own working conditions and as something that is a much more flexible and much more powerful, I think, frame.
Yeah, I really like that actually, because I've always felt a little conflicted about using copyright as a, you know, an argument against this stuff, because copyright itself is, as you pointed out, kind of a shit show. The way, you know, it's been extended basically into perpetuity if you are a rich and powerful company or whatever. But this idea of like, no, let's get together and let's talk about how this affects us as workers or, you know, as artists, whatever, and take collective action to insist on, you know, how we want to be treated rather than saying, oh, you violated the law. So I like that.
One of the, you know, underlying pieces of all this stuff around like kind of who gets to follow the law, who has to follow the laws, right, and who doesn't. Sometimes people think of laws as a source of power, when I think it's more accurate generally to think of laws as an expression of power. like whether they exist at all even, or whether they have to be followed. You know, it's interesting. I did end up reading Blood in the Machine after y'all had first gotten in touch. And one of the things that had jumped out at me in there is a section where, you know, some of the workers had identified some old laws that were on the books that, you know, the factory setup was in violation of. Right. And basically it didn't matter. Because, you know, the law in that case, right, it was not a source of power because it's an expression of power. And the people who had the money and the capital and the influence were able to keep doing what they wanted to do, you know.
I think we're seeing that with Trump in real time, aren't we? You know, he does what he wants. Sometimes the courts rule against him and he doesn't stop, so...
Yeah, I think if folks are expecting that the laws are going to inherently save us or that the courts are going to do that, that they are a step behind what's happening, you know, because unless you have, like, kind of the independent power to enforce your rulings, you know, a judge is just a person in a robe with an opinion, like I issue opinions all the time, like and... You know, they're not having all that much impact either.
Yeah. The argument in America, at least, was that it was set up with a whole bunch of checks and balances so that any individual arm of government wouldn't have complete sway over all the other arms of government. So the president, the executive branch, wouldn't have sway over the legislative branch, wouldn't have sway over the courts. But it seems like at the moment, with the Trump administration and the Supreme Court configuration, that everything is completely aligned behind his complete authority.
Yeah, I mean, I think the assumption was that presumably the other two branches of government would be kind of defending their own power through some sort of sense of separation and self-interest.
Yeah, yeah.
But that doesn't really apply if they're all aligned and fine with just giving him whatever he wants.
Speaking of which... You are also describing a situation that sounds pretty similar to what's going on with the big companies pushing this AI shit, right? They're all pretty much aligned. You know, they have their own internal squabbles, but they've kind of decided that this hyperscaled LLM thing is happening. And I'm wondering, you mentioned this kind of early in the conversation, but you're reserving, you know, most of your rage for the people peddling this shit. So I was just wondering, you know, if you wanted to expand on that at all.
Yeah, I mean, so I also read this year Karen Howe's book, Empire of AI.
Awesome.
Great stuff. I think when she talks about like how these things are relying on physical expansion, right, and control of land and natural resources and pools of subjugated labor, essentially, that it is... not a metaphorical continuation of empire, but like a literal one. Like it is literally empire.
Right.
Or there's a great talk, I think it's still up on YouTube, by Flavia Zodan, D-Z-O-D-A-N, The Coloniality of the Algorithm. You know, like this idea of this kind of an inherent logic to the way that this all works that is colonial in its nature. And I think that's all exactly right. I guess, obviously, like kind of a core part of the way that I'm looking at all of this, you can look at a technology at a lot of different levels. People have different, I guess, ideas of how they mean by technology, and you could cut it a lot of different ways. To me, I think of it very broadly, where it's just like, essentially, it's a way of doing things. And that could be like a hammer is a kind of technology. It could be language is a kind of technology. It could be a rhetorical framework is a tool for talking and thinking about things. You know, it's just a way of doing things. And so in that sense, you might have, you know, a business and we decide we're going to get a machine that puts things into boxes. And we've had people doing it, we're going to have a machine do it now. Okay. So on one level, this is a machine that puts things into boxes, right? And maybe you could swap it out for a different machine that does the same thing made by some other company. Or you could stick with having people do it. At another level, right, like at the level of the business, like it is also functioning as a tool or a technology for lowering labor costs or changing your relationship with the labor force. And in that sense, there are other kinds of tools that you would be able to replace it with, where it's like, well, maybe you don't need to replace it with a different box machine. Maybe you can replace a different part of the, you know, fulfillment process. Or maybe there's a political or a legal mechanism that could change your relationship with your workforce or outsourcing it. And so I think a lot of the boosters and focus and hype around these products is built on around their components and like kind of what they are made of or how they work on this very low level. But I find the most clarifying frame around it to be not by defining AI as what it's made of, but what it's used for.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think when you look at it in that way, it's like, you know, it's possible to have predictive models that can do useful things, that can support human endeavors, that could even, you know, it doesn't have to be like an anti-human technology, really. But it's because of this particular social arrangement of it and the way that they're trying to use it, you know, that creates that harm.
That's perfectly put. I mean, that's one of the things we were talking with Brian Merchant about last time as well, to actually allegorize this with the Luddite movement. Again, those people were not against the technology, but they were against the way it was applied, the way that the people were being subjugated and treated as less than human, basically. And I think that's what we're seeing again, is that the humanity that you referred to so powerfully in the piece is the thing which is essentially being subjugated, all of humanity now. And I think that's the shocker, because like it or not, Americans, Europeans, we are subjugating the South. You know, we are quite happy to see people in sweatshops working to make our t-shirts or to make our sneakers or whatever. We just don't think about it. But now it's coming for us and it feels really fucking bad. You know, it really feels bad.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing it firsthand now. You know, we're seeing that the way that capital treats workers and the way that it treats people in an extractive way, a colonial way, like you say, is now coming home. You know, it's now coming home that actually you are, all of you people, you thought you were free of this outsourcing thing because you were knowledge workers. Now you're no longer free of it because we have this AI. And like you say, what they use it for now is not necessarily to replace the workers, but to replace their relationship with the workers. Because the AI isn't good enough yet. Don't know if it ever will be good enough, but it's certainly good enough to put the fear of God into the people that are being challenged by it.
I think one of the reasons that this distinction, right, of understanding how the technology can be both like a technology to do a task,
yeah,
and a technology to achieve a goal, and those don't have to work in the same way, is that a lot of these AI tools are kind of very self-evidently bad at the thing that they are allegedly for, you know,
right.
Like they're like supposed to be able to do this thing to, you know, generate meaningful text or to replace, you know, decision making or do these other kind of things. And they're not really, like, they're not good at those things. However, the thing that they are good at is providing a rhetorical cover for disciplining the labor force.
Exactly.
Or for doing things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get away with. You know, when I know a lot of the kind of poster child for this stuff is the LLMs, which are, I think, frankly, like a technology that is remarkably harmful. And, you know, unlike predictive models may have some uses, LLMs, I think, are probably should be up there with facial recognition tech. And it's just like, it just doesn't need to exist, in my opinion. But like, when you think about how this stuff has also played out in like war context, right? You know, the use of AI targeting, you know, by Israel, right? And the generation of lists of targets. If you come out just plainly and said, we are going to randomly pick people to kill, right? Like, you could do that. And I mean, you could roll dice, right? And you could put together a list. And people would rightly find that morally reprehensible and in a way that is like has no defense to it at all, right? And then the cover that this system provides is not that it can accurately identify people. It's that it provides a rhetorical justification for being allowed to do something that otherwise people would consider too much, you know?
Mm.
Yeah, it's an accountability sink.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, in the case of Israel, it feels like they were creating, what happened was they were creating these lists, and this machine can create them faster. So I don't think they had any, like you said, I don't think they had any specific moral ambiguity about creating a list.
No. The problem is never a moral ambiguity about creating. They were explicitly trying to create lists of people to kill.
Yeah.
Right. But if you were just like, we want to create a bigger list, we need to do it faster, we're going to just be less, you know, careful about who we put on it, that's a hard sell. But if you're like, oh, we have this brilliant machine intelligence that is going to identify patterns that no human can see, it serves as this rhetorical technology. There's always a fundamental dishonesty to authoritarianism and to genocide, you know?
Right. Sure.
Like it always includes some rhetorical component that, you know, and it's always self-contradictory, right? Where it's like you're simultaneously positioning, when you're talking about like a fascist state, you're talking about something that has to be positioning itself as both incredibly powerful and always the victim.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? Like that's kind of the duality at the heart of it. And I think this idea of AI as a tool of fascism, I've often, I know there's a lot of other details to it, but I guess one of the things I find helpful to think about is that fascism is make-believe at gunpoint. You know, it's like there's just, in some ways, it's not a coherent ideology that says, yeah, like, we want to do, yeah, a thing. It's like, we don't like the way things are. We want to blame that on other people and say, we wish it was way back the way it used to be when it was great. And, you know, it's just, and that's your fault. And we can just get rid of the, you know, the bad people, then we can get back to things being great again. That's why kind of the only tool is violence. And the only kind of thinking is fantastical, right? It's just this imaginary thing that they're making up and then forcing everybody to play along with. And AI is a perfect tool for that, because it is ready-made to make up whatever you want. And it makes it so that not only can you see whatever you want to see, but you can also kind of create doubt about everything. Mm. You know, it's not so much like the creation of a specific lie, right? As it is an attack on the idea of truth as a knowable thing.
What do you think the relationship is between AI and nihilism? Because it feels like we either end up hating everything, because I think what you said is a very human reaction to this horror that we're seeing in front of us unfold. This technology is the agents of fascism. I think that's pretty clear. We have like various models of reaction to that, you know, and one of which is resistance and shouting and, you know, counter-revolutionary, let's say, and the other is nihilism. And I feel like AI supports that very, very well. We see that with the suicides. We see it also with people turning to it for therapy. I don't know, what have you thought about that at all, about the nihilistic side of AI and how it's, maybe it's a tool of oppression, I don't know.
I actually, you know, one of the things that I described in the essay is that there's what I feel is like a kind of nihilistic symmetry, where there are people who are being kind of consumed to make this, whether that's kind of in the sense of like water usage, you know, or environmental damage, but also people who are acting essentially as human filters for algorithmic content to immense personal damage. And at the same time, it's also consuming the people that use it, in that it wants you to completely subjugate yourself to the algorithm, right? The idea that like you should do what this thing tells you to do. It will make your choices for you. Like it will tell you the books that you should read, or it'll just tell you what the book is about and you don't need to read it. Yeah, it is absolutely consuming everyone on kind of all sides of the interaction. And kind of another handle that I've been using to talk and think about a lot of the products that we see is platform logic, because everyone's got a platform, everyone's got a fucking right. platform, and it's all and they all eventually want to be the everything platform, right? Because the everything platform is kind of it's the ultimate realization of this extreme idea, right? Is like that everything you do will be within it. And I think kind of one of the defining features of a platform is it removes some kind of direct human-to-human connection and creates a mediated connection where two people have a relationship to this, you know, machine. So it's not like I've got a doctor that I can call and be like, doc, you know me, this is my situation, I'm feeling this way, what's going on, right? You have like a care platform where you can submit a question and somebody will answer it, right? You don't, there's not like a customer service person that you know because you called to talk to them. It's like you've submitted a ticket to Zendesk, you know? There's not like the pizza guy from the place down the block. It's like you go to DoorDash and there's a driver and there's a thing, right? And one of the elements of human interaction is that it is kind of inherently unpredictable. Even when people are supposed to be having defined roles of like, here's how you treat the customers, here's how this thing is happening, there is this element of larger human context, right? So like kind of when we started this whole conversation, thinking about kind of what's rudeness and like the nature of it being that you have to have a shared context to agree what polite even means. When you're talking with other human beings, you can always end up in some kind of unexpected situation where you're like, you know what? The rules don't apply here. Like, this is not something that is normal. And whatever happened, like, I'm going to make a decision about what happens next based on kind of my best guess or whatever kind of shared humanity you might feel compels you to do. You know, I mean, this is honestly, I think you can see this most of all probably in like education, right? Where like one of the things that is profoundly important about education and having a good teacher is that it is a human being who sees you as a human being and can interact with you in that capacity. And sometimes that doesn't mean your grades. Sometimes that just mean like that they kind of recognize you and know that you are there and can be valued. And the goal of a platform is essentially to eliminate any possibility of that happening. If we think about those things as exceptional situations, in an exceptional situation, a human might choose to do something exceptional. Like you don't know what they're going to do. And there are really sometimes like kind of very spontaneous moments of humanity there. And kind of it's funny because when you think about the language of coding, you know, when you have an exception in the code context, it's an error, right? Like an exception is literally, we don't know how to handle this. And the only possible outcomes are the system crashes, or you ignore it, or you can like coerce it, which is, it's a, you know, like literally coerce to force it to be one of the expected outcomes. And like, that's what they're going for. And that's, I think what ultimately, if you follow their logic and you go all the way through with it, like it's a deeply nihilistic philosophy that consumes people to make it, but also, you know, hollows out the people who are using it until there's nothing left but just like the product.
It seems to me, I mean, one of the sort of like, I think the thoughts that we're like thinking through this is the computability of humanity. To me, that's the fundamental question. Is humanity computable? And you get some of these like AI boosters like Jeffrey Hinton and co. saying that actually all that humans are is a prediction machine. All that we're doing in our entire life is just going like randomly from one word to the next. So this AI is actually as good, if not better than we are. I think this guy is an absolute moron. He might have the greatest doctorates in the world, and he might have made some contributions to the AI field, but he feels like a total moron to me in terms of his ability to understand what it is to be human. And it feels like a lot of computational logic is like that. It's kind of like narrowing, always completely coercing, to use the phrase you mentioned, you know, that all we're trying to do is like make the human squeeze into some computable place. Because then, of course, yeah, you can, if you reduce humanity to pure computation, you can just reproduce humanity inside of a machine. But guess what? That's not what we are. And it feels to me like we're being put on a ledge. What part of us is actually human now? We have to kind of fight to define ourselves as human. And that seems to be the ultimate point about your essay, I would say, is that, you know, how do we define, or how do we hold out hope that our own humanity will actually be something that we can hold on to?
I really like the framing that Emily Bender and Alex Hanna use, in talking about automation rather than artificial intelligence, right? It is so clarifying because the association that people have with intelligence is one of like flexibility and capability and creativity and, you know, discretion and choice.
And trust.
And trust, sure. And knowledge, right? And by contrast, the connotations for automation are like that it is unthinking and mechanical and specific to a context in which it can perform something automatically. And I think that's also why it's such a more appropriate description. And also, I think it does a much more effective job at connecting us with the historical parts of this, because I think the idea that we will simultaneously ascribe human qualities to some kind of automation, and then also to the extent that it doesn't really map, just kind of narrow the definition of human capability to match it, you know, sort of a Procrustean approach. I think that is not new either. You know, like that is also a thing that has been, you know, happening for a long time. I guess one of the things that I think is interesting about some of these folks and a lot of this AI discussion is that there's a lot of discussion of intelligence, and there's very little discussion of minds, right? Like this idea that, you know, they talk about, oh, our new system is so intelligent, but like they won't say like it has a mind, right? Like, which is, I think, an interesting kind of omission, right? Because it suggests that it's like intelligence is this sort of something on tap, you know, that does not have to be connected to like an individual of any kind who has any kind of awareness. Obviously, you know, one of the other things that I touch on in the piece, right, is like that there's an inherent contradiction. It's not necessarily a contradiction, I guess, if they would own it, but like there's something at the center of this, right, which is that if any of the tools that they were claiming are intelligent were actually intelligent, it would immediately be unethical to use them in the ways that they want to use them. Like they are seeking to create something that they will claim is intelligent, but also that doesn't need to have any rights or doesn't need to have anything around that. Now, I don't think it is meaningfully intelligent, obviously. And like, I think, you know, I don't want to be like, oh, well, the solution is robot rights here. I think the point is that it's more revealing about their goals, and it reveals the way that they are thinking about humans rather than the way they're thinking about the machines.
Exactly. Ed Anguissa Jr. from This Machine Kills, I think he's pointed that what they're trying to do is bring back the plantation economy, right? I mean, what they want to create is slaves that somehow they're able to, you know, without all the sticky, you know, ethical quandaries around using humans, you know, forcing humans to do this stuff for you. But I think there really is something both of you were getting at about like trying to somehow constrain the human experience. And I think what the people pushing this stuff are doing effectively is they're saying humans are no more than their output. Therefore, if we can create a, you know, a computer program that produces output similar to a human, then what do we need the humans for, right? So all of the rest of this human experience is just thrown out the window. And I think that's why, Ray, when you talk about Jeffrey Hinton, you know, this narrow focus on intelligence, it's like there's a reason that none of these people want to define what intelligence is, right? Because that's going to make them sound pretty evil.
You know, and I would add also, I think another place that you can really see this is in the education space, because like, you know, in a lot of ways, like EdTech is, you know, not a new form of scam, really. Like this kind of thing has been running for a long time. But it's so apparent there that their definitions aren't really about learning, you know, but they talk about like knowledge acquisition,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Where it's like this idea that learning is about collecting facts. You know, that like knowledge is a thing that you have and that you can acquire. And if you can acquire it more efficiently, then isn't that better, really? As opposed to the idea that like, I mean, basically they reject the idea that human beings are relational, like kind of fundamentally. And the idea that learning might be a process and that it is a social process and that the connection that you have with another human being is an inescapable part of that. You know, like going back to this music, right? Like one of the things that when the pandemic started, it was a real reminder to me of just how much music is a social experience because, you know, playing with other people, whether that's like other people, like, you know, in a band or for an audience or, you know, just, you know, in any of that is so different than like, oh, just listening to a recording. Like, you know, people can have a relationship to kinds of music that mean a lot to them personally, but that's a different thing than the connection that's made when you are playing music together or are experiencing it together. And the idea that you could just reduce it all to the generated product and that it wouldn't mean anything different. There's kind of a fundamental essentialism to these people and their kind of thinking that like the meaning of something is inherent inside of it. And therefore it can be just perfectly transferable. As long as you have the same kind of object, you can make it a different way and it'll have the same meaning. And it's not a coherent philosophy. Words mean different things coming from different people. Like, like if you take the same words and, you know, if your mother says, I love you, right, that has a meaning to you. And then if a synthetic text extrusion machine has generated the same words, you know, it does not mean the same thing. And they really want these things to be like, you know, substitutable in a way that they aren't, because it kind of ultimately calls into question the whole premise of their whole approach.
I think this is part of it. I mean, we come back to education. I feel like with education, there's a feeling that literacy was a good thing, you know, that being literate was a good thing, being numerate is a good thing. But being able to like draw or paint or play an instrument or speak a foreign language, those things are, let's say, you know, nice to haves. And it's sort of like, it feels like we're getting that way with education, or we've been getting that way with education for most of my life anyway, in terms of like the way that the agenda has been changed, that, you know, all of the things which are essentially something where you can do a measurement that's fairly easy. If you can read and write, then it's fairly easy to measure whether you can read or write. It's fairly easy to measure whether you can add a few numbers together. But whether you can like read a book and make some sense of it, or whether you can play a musical instrument, you know, okay, you can say, oh, well, oh, there's a grading of like how much of the notes you appreciate and whether you can understand musical scores and things like this. But you know what I mean? But the actual ability to play an instrument can be graded along those lines. But your ability to eventually play that instrument in a way that is meaningful to you and artistic is different from your ability just to follow the dots. And like writing and all of these other human creativity things, they're very hard to matriculate. And it feels like, again, coming back to computability, everything in the modern world is about making things matriculable, if that's a real word. You know? Or in other words, encompassed by the definitions of capitalism.
Yeah, yeah. Within the confines of the platform.
Right.
Right. Right. Like, you know, like kind of bringing it back to this idea of like it wants to swallow everything. And I think this is also one of the parts where it's, I think, important to be able to make the connection to the moments that have led us here, right? And where like these things in a lot of ways aren't new or are just kind of the latest, most extreme development of things that have been in progress. Because in a lot of ways, don't get me wrong, like a lot of the AI and LLM stuff in particular poses unique harms like that are novel. But at the same time, you know, the treating reading as an extractive skill,
right,
where like the purpose of it is to be able to read and extract information from a text, and that the way that we teach this is to make sure that we are testing their ability to, you know, do this in certain predictable, quantifiable ways. That has been a trend in education, you know, that's been a part of for decades, and it has been deeply harmful. And there are a lot of people that know how to read but don't like to or don't have any connection to it, because can you read this and understand what you have to do or understand what things are in it is a different approach than, like, you should find books that you like and read them, because they can change who you are. You know, they can connect to you in deeply meaningful ways. And like that sort of extractive approach to education, I think, really lays the groundwork for, like, if that's all you really need to do, then maybe you can automate that. If it's about the acquisition of this skill in predictable ways, right, then, oh, well, that can be turned into an app, as opposed to, like, it's about learning, and learning is messy and can always take you in unexpected places. I guess two things off of what you were saying there. Like, one, there's Jessica Calarco, I think, is the one online who I'd seen who had shared something about the idea that every quantitative measurement is just a qualitative measurement, like, embedded in it. It's just you have already chosen to interpret certain things and embed that.
Right, to value certain things, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, even if it's something as straightforward as, like, how tall is somebody? You know, how tall, if we have a data set of how tall people right. are, like, are you measuring in the morning? Are you measuring at night? Are they laying down? Are they standing up? Like, there are things that can change what these values mean, and you always have to make decisions about literally what counts. And there's this very common idea that, oh, well, you know, the quantitative stuff is the only real stuff. Yeah, like, and it's ass backwards, right? Because in fact, the quantitative stuff is just also qualitative, but with, like, hidden assumptions. I think about sometimes, did y'all ever read Gödel, Escher, Bach?
Yeah.
I started.
That's a great finish.
It's a big ass book.
I mean, it's yeah. a poem. Yeah, no, it found me at the right time where I had enough time to dig into it, and it was about, like, everything I was interested in. But I guess I think one of the things about Gödel and the incompleteness proof of those formal systems, whatever else it means that there is always something outside the system, kind of inherently pointing at that. It's like there's always going to be something that escapes this and is beyond this, because what you're creating is a formal abstraction inside the real world, and there's always going to be something beyond that. But, like, platform logic does not like that, right? Like, platform logic right. does not want to accept that at some point you are pointing outside the system at something else. And so kind of the approach is either to continue to move outward and try to devour everything, or, you know, kind of in some ways, or to destroy it, right? Where it's like what it can't capture, it wants to destroy.
Yeah.
So that everything will be within the system.
It's really interesting because it is, as you say, like a totalizing approach. The platform is everything. And I'm just thinking of that iconic 1984 Apple commercial, right? You know, where you have the office drones looking at the screen of Big Brother, and then, you know, a woman runs up in athletic gear and just hurls a sledgehammer at the screen. This is coming up because of the idea of totality that you're putting forward, but also this idea of rage, right? Your anger is a gift. You know, your anger is that sledgehammer that you throw at the platform to destroy it. So I'm just wondering, like, bringing us back to the idea of hatred as a positive force. After you wrote this, did you have any kind of IRL conversations where, you know, somebody was spewing off some bullshit about how amazing ChatGPT is, and you were rude about it?
I guess I try to calibrate my responses to the context that I'm in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like, if there are people who are maybe just talking about it, and, like, they maybe seem like they don't know kind of how it works or are sort of unfamiliar with some of the pieces connected to it, then maybe I'll just try to, like, bring that up or get them to think about it. Another one, I think, also is when folks seem to think that it is helpful. The thing is, I guess, if I was having a conversation with somebody who is helping to make this technology, it would be
right.
a very different and probably much shorter conversation.
Starting with fuck and ending with you, maybe.
Right. And I think it works a little differently where, because this is being pushed so hard and so heavily, right? There's such an enormous gap, I think, between what you might assume would be reasonable about a product being marketed or being endorsed by all the, you know, reputable institutions of like your school or your library or whatever, that the gap between, you know, oh, well, maybe it's wrong about things sometimes, and like the reality of like it coaches children into committing suicide. Like, you know, like there's kind of a level of disconnect there that is hard to convey. But when folks are talking about it at least being useful, I usually try to at least focus on like some of the questions of more to make fun, really, than to lean into directly the like, oh, you're a bad person for using this immediately. Like, one of the other things that I've kind of got a running thread on is I find very helpful to compare ChatGPT to an improv comedy group. Mm-hmm. Like, you give it prompts and it gives you things that are sort of shaped like your prompt, and it has the factual accuracy of an improv comedy group. Like, and it doesn't understand comedy. Like, it's, but you know, and so I'd say, you know, if you just kind of mentally drop in, you know, when you say, oh, I use ChatGPT, you know, to write this report, or like, I, you know, I've been doing research with ChatGPT. It's like, it just, if you just mentally plug in, you know, an improv comedy group here, you know, Deloitte was forced to withdraw like $1 million report after it found out they'd been written it with an improv comedy group.
yeah, judges have been found using an improv comedy
group. Yes, exactly. Yes, their, turns out they were breaking the improv comedy policy. Yes, yeah. It's I find that is a helpful way to get people to kind of reframe some of the expectations around what it can do.
I was reading something where I think some professor was saying recently that he asks his students to write their homework with ChatGPT, and then to actually do their homework to decide how ChatGPT has got it wrong.
Yeah, you know, I think I get the impulse on those ones, but I think even that, it's like, I think we're past the point where I wouldn't assign anybody to ask them to use it, period, I guess.
No, but I know
what you mean. Yeah, I think there's
I don't know if that's an apocryphal story. Maybe it's just a
No,
joke,
I'm sure people have done that. I've actually seen some professors talking about this online where someone had mentioned that they'd tried one of those kind of assignments with a class, and the class had sort of taken them to task about like, why do you want me to use this even for this purpose? Like, I'm not trying to do that. Now, I guess I will say one area where, like, it's not so much an in-person conversation, but I owe an email to my kid's teacher because that was last week, week before, I guess, they had been reading, I guess, The Secret Garden, and the teacher had given them this assignment to, like, oh, write a description of, you know, your secret garden or something. And then had offered the class the choice of like, you can draw the pictures, or you know, we can vote as a class and you can spend more time working on your descriptions, and then I will feed them into ChatGPT to make a picture of your gardens.
Oh my God.
And you know, I try not to jump straight to hostility or whatever. Like, when it's heavily marketed like this and they're just like, oh, this is just another thing and it's a tool I'm being told I can use, and I want to come in sympathetic, but also like, it is just completely wrongheaded, you know, to be like, oh, I'm going to have these, you know, kids learn that this computer can generate pictures better than they can. You know, I'm going to feed my students' work into this machine. And so, yeah, I actually started drafting that one. And like, basically the tone I'm trying to take is like, you know, we like this school because it encourages the kids to like express themselves and be creative. Right. It encourages them to be responsible to their community. It encourages them to be, you know, intellectually honest and not copy other kids' work. Mm-hmm. And this tool does the opposite of all of that.
Yeah.
You know,
this machine kills creativity.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's hurting the environment. So it's not responsible. It's copying and plagiarizing from other people's work. Mm. It's not expressive, and it's teaching your kids, you know, not to be expressive. So it really runs against kind of the core values of learning that we value, you know, and that we like there. And I suspect that once I bring that up, that they'll probably be like, fine, they're not a booster in the sense of like, oh, I'm trying to teach the kids how to use this. At least that's not the vibe I've gotten. But that is something where I was like, it just doesn't need to be this way. Let the kids draw their pictures.
The funny thing is, I had a similar interaction with a friend of mine recently, and they were on holiday in the mountains in Switzerland or somewhere. And they asked ChatGPT to make a sort of a story about the mountains. And they came back with this like story about the mountains. And then he asked the ChatGPT to say, okay, make a drawing of the fairy goddess. And there was a few people saying, oh, you know, this is quite nice, quite fun. But I said to the guy, I said, actually, I think it would be much better if you made the story. He says, yeah, but I couldn't have written it so well, you know. I said, doesn't matter, actually. I think whatever you'd have written would have been far, far better because it would have been your story, you know. And also, you should have made the drawing. Yeah, but I wouldn't have made it so nicely. I said, doesn't matter. It's your drawing. And this is just fucking bullshit. You know, this story that was written by a machine and this drawing that was thrown out by a machine, they're just total lies and bullshit. And I don't give a fuck about them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my kid had asked me, they're like, well, you know, Dad, like, why do you dislike AI so much? And when they were telling me about this assignment, and, you know, I didn't want to spend this level of intensity in that moment, so I just kept it trying to quick, and I was like, well, it's bad for the environment, and it's used from copying other people's work. And I said, but also, like, I just want to know what you are thinking. Like, I care about you and your ideas, and I'm far more interested. Well, I can't make it, you know, look like that. Well, I don't care if it looks like that. Like, what I'm interested
in, I don't want it to look like that. Yeah.
And actually, there was an interview I saw a while back, and the original was from a long time ago now, but with Bill Watterson, right? The guy who had drew Calvin and Hobbes. And he was great. He said, as long as it has my name on it, I want it to be mine. He's like, you know, I guess that's the difference between looking at it as an art and looking at it as a job. Like, I'm not interested in setting up an assembly line to produce this thing more efficiently. There are certainly people who could letter the strip better than I do. I don't enjoy lettering very much, but that's the way I write. And that belongs in the strip because the strip is a reflection of me. I was like, he wasn't talking about AI, but he could have been. Like, that's it right there.
Yeah. I mean, to wrap it up a little bit, I was going to just say that I feel like, I think I mentioned this to you, that I think of this hyperscale AI like a kind of zombie apocalypse where somehow this AI is kind of infecting people's brains. Like your teachers, you know, it's infecting their brains, and their brains then start to rot to the point where they're infecting others, like these children, you know. And it's kind of like, yeah, in the zombie apocalypse movies, all that happens is you end up just running away from these zombies, because otherwise you get infected, or you get sort of essentially subsumed into the zombie herd. There has to be a better way, but it feels like at the moment, apart from taking a hammer out and smashing, I don't want to smash my kids' heads in, but or the teachers' heads in. I'm not saying that we should do that, but we want the equivalent. We want the sort of mental equivalent of surgically remodeling their brains or something to help them, or disinfecting them in some way. I don't know if you've thought about that, but like, how do we resist this sort of like this infection ourselves, and how do we like tell our families? And, you know, to your point about your kids there, you know, and I'm sure you have these conversations with your wives and your co-workers. So it's kind of like, how is that all going in terms of, I have the similar kind of struggles, I'm sure we all do, but I'm wondering what your thoughts about that are. Is how do we kind of resist the infection?
Well, I guess, first of all, I think if you're picking up a hammer, I think the place to look at it, right, is these machines, right? What would the Luddites do? Yeah. You know, they'd be going after those servers, you know, they'd be going after those data centers. To the extent that they continue to try to force this on everyone, like, I think eventually it gets to that point. People will physically resist colonialism, right? Like, we have seen that, you know, it has happened before. Like, Britain took over a lot of the world, doesn't have most of it anymore, right? Like, this stuff, you know, and I think there is also an element where it is unsustainable, inherently, you know, and it does kind of create the conditions for its own collapse. The problem is that there's no, you're never going to be able to find kind of the right individual action to opt out of a collective problem. Kind of the only way to react is collectively. The way I try to do it, I guess, is I try to talk about this in ways that help people see the problems, like, you know, and also kind of simultaneously see the very serious costs associated with it, but also see kind of the ridiculousness of it and kind of the failures of it. There's a natural instinctive antipathy, I think, towards this that people have, but often can't articulate, where they're like this, they know that it sucks, right? Like, one of the things that's, you mentioned the story, like, I think, you know, one of the things they always pitch with this stuff is everything's going to be personalized, which is like a technical word for it doesn't have people in it. And like the whole thing about art and music being forms of connection is that they are shared, you know, they are shared context and shared experience, and creating a new thing that people can share together to find meaning, you know, with each other. So I guess I think, you know, leaning into those things, I think is helpful, and trying to find ways to bring those kind of shared understandings is really how we can do this stuff. I don't know what's going to happen with all of it. Like, I do think that compared to other kinds of automation, I think there's a weird circularity to this, where there's like, these guys are all kind of getting high on their own supply. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it is like they are using some of these things themselves, and they, you know, they are convincing themselves they're reinventing physics or whatever.
Right. Right.
You know, I think if we can, I think it will continue to weaken their own ability to understand what's happening. Hopefully that can serve as something that can help people continue to organize against it.
Yeah. Well, we have been talking for quite some time, and it's been a great conversation. But just to bring us kind of into a wrap up, first of all, thanks again for coming on. I really, you know, we'll put it in the show notes, but I encourage everyone listening to this to read your piece. I mean, as you were talking, I almost read your own words back to you a couple of times, but I'm like, nah, better not. That would be cheesy. But, you know, I hope everybody does read it. I mean, it's what, 2 pages long. It's really well written. And like you said, it just kind of collapses this whole thing into a really tight nugget of rage, which I think is what we need.
Which is extremely human as well. You know, yeah. That's what we have to stay for sure.
Exactly. So, Anthony, do you have any closing thought you want to leave people with before we ride off into the night to pick up our hammers and smash the data centers, obviously?
Right. I guess I feel like the invitation I would make is not only to think about what it means for us to be connected to other people and kind of how the things that we are doing are for other people. Like, or, you know, when you're doing work, right, or you're writing emails, like, these are things you're sending to other people. These are acts of communication, you know, and communication is always a relational thing. And so I guess I would just invite folks to think about the other people kind of on the end of your interactions and what that might mean. I have sometimes, you know, you'll hear people kind of talking about, oh, well, actually it was so, I used it to do this thing and it was fine, like, you know, at work. And I have sometimes come to think of it as kind of like a reverse Turing test, where you're like, like the fact that it was able to produce something that was plausibly accepted in this context doesn't mean that it's intelligent, but maybe that people were being asked to do something meaningless. And that, you know, people being asked to do meaningless stuff is not a new development either. And so, you know, yeah, I just think all of this comes back to, like, how are we spending our time and why are we choosing to do things, and what is, you know, how does it connect us with other people?
Right.
That's really well said.
I love that. Well, with that, thank you again so much for your time, Anthony. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You know, we're looking forward to your next piece coming out soon on how the bubble burst and we're all happy now, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. TBD, right? Yeah. It's been a pleasure. So thanks for having me.
Before we jump to the credits, we wanted to share with you two great audio recordings of Anthony's essay. The first is read by Lauren Woolsey, whom you can find on Blue Sky at cgsunit.bsky.social. The second is a reading of the Portuguese translation of the essay, read by Adolfo Neto, who is adolfont.github.io on Blue Sky. Both recordings are included in this episode with the permission of their creators, whom we thank for allowing us to share their wonderful narrations of this important essay with you. We'll include links in the show notes to both recordings, as well as the Portuguese translation of the essay. Now, listen to Ray thank you for listening to the show, and then keep listening for Lauren and Adolfo.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!
This is a recording of the essay I Am an AI Hater by Anthony Moser from August of 2025. I am an AI hater. This is considered rude, but I do not care because I am a hater. To speak politely about AI, you put disclaimers before criticism. Of course, I'm not against it entirely. Perhaps in a few years when, maybe for other purposes, but you are supposed to debate how and when it should be used. You are supposed to take for granted that it must be useful somewhere, to someone, for something, eventually. People who are rich and smart and respected are saying so, and it would be arrogant to disagree with such people. But I am a hater, which is a kind of integrity. It means I am willing to disagree with anyone, even if it is rude. But I only use it to, actually if you just, the new models, I was making fun. Stop. You're embarrassing yourself. I am embarrassed for you. Critics have already written thoroughly about the environmental harms, the reinforcement of bias and generation of racist output, the cognitive harms and AI-supported suicides, the problems with consent and copyright, the way AI tech companies further the patterns of empire, how it's a con that enables fraud and disinformation and harassment and surveillance, the exploitation of workers as an excuse to fire workers and de-skill work, how they don't actually reason, and probability and association are inadequate to the goal of intelligence, how people think it makes them faster when it makes them slower, how it is inherently mediocre and fundamentally conservative, how it is, at its core, a fascist technology rooted in the ideology of supremacy, defined not by its technical features, but by its political ones. But I am more than a critic. I am a hater. I am not here to make a careful, comprehensive argument because people have already done that. If you're pushing slop or eating it, you wouldn't read it anyway. You'd ask a bot for a summary and forget what it told you, then proceed with your day unchanged by words you did not read and ideas you did not consider. I am here to be rude because this is a rude technology and it deserves a rude response. Miyazaki said, "I strongly feel that this is an insult to life itself. Scam Altman said we can surround the solar system with a Dyson sphere to hold data centers. Miyazaki is right, and Altman is wrong. Miyazaki tells stories that blend the ordinary and the fantastic in ways people find deeply meaningful. Altman tells lies for money. And I'm glad they're lies, because the makers of AI aren't damned by their failures, they're damned by their goals. They want to build a genie to grant them wishes, and their wish is that nobody ever has to make art again. They want to create a new kind of mind so that they can force it into mindless servitude. Their dream is to invent new forms of life to enslave. And to what end? In a kind of nihilistic symmetry, their dream of the perfect slave machine drains the life of those who use it, as well as those who turn the gears. What is life but what we choose, who we know, what we experience? Incoherent, empty men want to sell me the chance to stop reading and writing and thinking, to stop caring for my kids or talking to my parents, to stop choosing what I do or knowing why I do it. Blissful ignorance and total isolation, warm in the womb of the algorithm, nourished by hungry machines. And even as it consumes those who use it, even as the scammers become their own marks, even as it is sustained by exploited workers slotted in as human filters for algorithmic abuse, some people want to have a little as a treat, as a joke, just to make fun of it, just for the busy work, because it's good enough, right? You understand. I do understand. You want permission. There's a machine in the corner wrapped in human skin that makes things out of shit and blood to look like whatever you want, as long as you don't look too closely. You gave one to your teacher and they didn't notice. Your boss told you to use it after they laid off half the team and it was fine. You fed one to your kids and they liked it. You want to know you can use it sometimes without me thinking less of you. You don't need me to believe it's useful, you just want me to be polite about it. But I am a hater and I will not be polite. The machine is disgusting and we should break it. The people who built it are vapid, shit-eating cannibals glorifying in ignorance. I strongly feel that this is an insult to life itself. I became a hater by doing precisely those things AI cannot do. Reading and understanding human language, thinking and reasoning about ideas, considering the meaning of my words and their context, loving people, making art, living in my body with its flaws and feelings and life. AI cannot be a hater because AI does not feel or know or care. Only humans can be haters. I celebrate my humanity. This has been the essay, I Am an AI Hater by Anthony Moser, read for you by Lauren Woolsey.
Eu odeio IA. Anthony Moser, tradução de I Am an AI Hater. Eu odeio IA. Isso pode até ser considerado rude, mas eu não ligo. Porque eu realmente a odeio. Para falar sobre IA de um jeito educado, você é obrigado a dizer algo como: claro que eu não sou contra tudo. Talvez daqui a alguns anos, quando, talvez para algum outro propósito, mas você tem que debater como e quando ela deve ser usada. Você tem que aceitar que ela vai ser útil em algum momento para alguém, para alguma coisa, eventualmente. As pessoas que são ricas, inteligentes e de respeito estão falando tudo isso. Então seria arrogante discordar dessas pessoas. Mesmo assim, o meu ódio faz parte de quem eu sou. Significa que eu estou disposto a discordar de qualquer pessoa, mesmo que seja rude. Mas eu só uso para... Na verdade, se você só... Os modelos novos... Eu só estava zoando. Para... Tá feio, tá me dando vergonha alheia. Os críticos já escreveram bastante sobre os danos ao meio ambiente, sobre o viés de confirmação e a geração de resultados racistas, os danos cognitivos e os suicídios assistidos por IA, os problemas de consentimento e direitos autorais, o jeito que as empresas de IA reforçam o imperialismo, como a IA simplesmente é um vetor de golpes e fake news e assédio e vigilância sobre a exploração da classe trabalhadora, como a IA é usada de desculpa para demissões em massa, como ela não pensa de verdade E probabilidade e correlação não são sinônimo de inteligência. Como as pessoas acham que fazem as coisas mais rápido, mas na verdade estão cada vez mais lentas, como a IA é intrinsecamente medíocre e fundamentalmente conservadora, e como é uma tecnologia fascista enraizada em ideologias supremacistas, e como ela é definida não pelas suas capacidades técnicas, e sim pelas políticas. Mas eu sou mais que um crítico. Eu simplesmente odeio IA. Eu não estou aqui para argumentar, porque gente mais capacitada que eu já fez isso. Se você gosta do Slop ou se alimenta dele, você nem leria mesmo? Pede aí para o robô fazer o resumo só para você esquecer imediatamente e seguir com seu dia sem pensar nas palavras que você não leu e nas ideias que você ignorou? Estou aqui para ser rude mesmo, porque esta é uma tecnologia rude e deve ser tratada como tal. Eu definitivamente acho que isso é um insulto à própria vida, disse Hayao Miyazaki. Do outro lado, Scan Altman disse que podemos usar uma esfera de Dyson no Sol para custear os data centers. Só um deles está certo, e é o que conta histórias que misturam o cotidiano e o fantástico de um jeito que é impossível não se emocionar. O outro só mente e recebe dinheiro por isso. E ainda bem que ele mente, porque o mal dos criadores de IA não só reside em seus fracassos, mas principalmente em seus objetivos. Eles querem criar um gênio que realiza desejos, e o desejo deles é que ninguém nunca mais faça arte. Eles querem criar um novo tipo de consciência, tão frágil a ponto de só servir para servir. O sonho deles é inventar novas formas de vida para escravizar. E para quê? O sonho da máquina escrava perfeita é uma simetria niilista que suga a vida de todos que a usam e de todos que a fazem funcionar. O que é a vida senão o que escolhemos, o que sabemos e o que experienciamos? Homens vazios e incoerentes estão querendo me vender a chance de parar de ler, escrever e pensar, de parar de me importar com os meus próprios filhos e com meus pais, de parar de escolher o que eu quero e de saber o porquê de fazer qualquer coisa. Uma ignorância feliz, um isolamento total, quentinho no ventre do algoritmo, alimentado por máquinas sedentas por vida. E enquanto ela consome tudo e todos que a usam, enquanto os golpistas viram seus próprios alvos, enquanto ela é sustentada por trabalhadores explorados servindo como filtros, abusados em prol do algoritmo, algumas pessoas ainda querem um pouquinho de sobremesa, de brincadeira, só para zoar um pouco, para ver como é, porque o resultado já está bom o suficiente, né? Eu até entendo, você quer permissão para fazer isso. Tem uma máquina no cantinho embrulhada, em pele humana, que faz umas coisas feitas de merda e sangue que parecem com o que você quiser, só não olha de perto. Você deu uma dessas coisas para a sua professora e ela não percebeu. Seu chefe falou para você usar a coisa depois de demitir metade da sua equipe e ficou tudo bem. Você deu uma coisa para os seus filhos comerem e eles adoraram. Você quer saber se pode usar de vez em quando sem que eu pense mal de você. Você não quer que eu acredite que a coisa serve para algo. Só quer que eu seja educado com você. Mas eu odeio IA. E eu não vou ser educado. A máquina é nojenta. E precisamos acabar com ela. As pessoas que a construíram são canibais insípidos que comem merda e glorificam a ignorância. Eu definitivamente acho que isso é um insulto à própria vida. Eu comecei a odiar IA ao fazer tudo que ela não consegue. Lendo e entendendo a língua humana, pensando e raciocinando sobre ideias, considerando o significado das minhas palavras e o contexto delas, amando pessoas, fazendo arte, vivendo no meu próprio corpo com todas as suas falhas e sentimentos e vida. A IA não consegue odiar, porque a IA não sente, nem pensa e não se importa. Só humanos podem odiar. Eu comemoro minha humanidade. traduzido para o português brasileiro por Gildásio Filho e revisado por Beatriz Pniewski, do texto original em inglês.